Hold the Line with Mike Solon is brought to you by the Seattle Police Officers Guild, Seattle's public safety voice.
I give full credit to SFPD for helping me find a pathway off the street.
The line must be drawn here. This far, no farther.
This is where we hold them. This is where we fight.
We will not go quietly into the night. We will not vanish. Not a fight. Hold the line!
Hey, welcome back to Hold the Line with Mike Solon. I have two very special guests in studio today. This is going to be round three of the homeless industrial complex conversation. This is a hot topic that continues to drive the public safety narrative, not only just in Seattle, but I think the entire West Coast, in particular San Francisco. In studio today, I have Tom Wolf. Thank you for being here, buddy. And of course, repeating customer from We Heart Seattle, the true leader of action in the city, is Andrew Suarez from We Heart Seattle. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Tom, thank you for coming here. For the people that don't know who the hell you are, because I've done a little bit of research on you. I've met you before, but I'm blown away by your story. And I think you resonate with me. It's compelling enough because you've lived the streets, and I would say that you're an expert on recovery. You're still in recovery.
Still in recovery.
And you're an expert on the drug problems that are plaguing our streets, the homeless conversation, everything wrapped into one. So who the hell are you? Tell the people that are going to be consuming this what you're all about.
Well, first of all, thanks, Mike, for having me on. I appreciate it. And Andrea, I'm grateful. So my name's Tom Wolf. I'm a recovery advocate based in San Francisco. I'm formerly homeless. In 2018, I lived on the streets of the Tenderloin neighborhood in San Francisco for 6 months. My homelessness was perpetuated by drug addiction. I got addicted to oxycodone in 2015 after surgery. That addiction spiraled into heroin addiction and eventually fentanyl, and led me to a situation of where I was kicked out of my home by my wife because I was terrorizing my wife and kids in my addiction. And I drove us to bankruptcy, and I ended up living on the street for 6 months. And it wasn't, you know, I mean, if it wasn't for the intervention that I received on the street in 2018 by the police, I give full credit to SFPD for helping me find a pathway off the street. I wouldn't be here today talking to you. And now I'm a nationally recognized recovery advocate. You know, again, San Francisco has an outsized problem with the drug and homeless crisis. We have somewhere between 8 and 20,000 people on the street. We had 806 overdose deaths last year in San Francisco. SFPD pulled well over 100 kilos of fentanyl out of just one neighborhood in San Francisco, the Tenderloin. And you know, my advocacy, you know, I work really hard to raise awareness and educate people, but really just to tell the truth about what life is like for people on the street, how hard it is to access drug treatment on the street, how a radicalized interpretation of harm reduction is actually causing harm to people on the street instead of helping them, and how we need to really, really place the focus back on creating what I call climates of recovery, where people have an opportunity to transform their lives and do better. And get healthy again.
Well, that's fantastic. It's out of your once was a negative story has become a positive story. And I can't wait to dig into it. But how do you know this leader in Seattle, Andrea Suarez from We Heart Seattle? How'd you two link up?
So we linked up through an organization called North America Recovers. It's not even really an organization. It's a coalition. It's not a nonprofit or anything. It's just a coalition of different groups and individuals that are like-minded. We actually kind of met because we both have an association with Michael Schellenberger and with some other folks too, that cross again, political spectrums from conservatives to Democrats. I'm a Democrat myself, but we're all facing the same kind of challenges in that we know that the system that is in place around addressing homelessness and drugs is not working, because if it was working, we'd see reductions in these areas, and we don't. We actually see an increase despite the massive amount of dollars spent across the Western United States on homelessness. So I met her because I know We Heart Seattle is doing great work up here. I think they have a really clever way of reaching into the homeless community by doing litter picks. And it's just a great way to break the ice and actually get people on the street involved in their surroundings by helping them clean it up. And I know that she's connected countless amounts of people to services, including housing and treatment. And I consider her a friend and an ally in this fight together.
Well, that's perfect, because this is now your third time, Andrew, because I'll steal your word, clever way. It is a clever way, and I think that's what enticed us to bring you on. In terms of the cops having respect for what you're doing and the litter picks is what really spawned this. So you want to elaborate on what the good man, Tom, just pumped your tires with?
Yeah, no problem. I had no idea 3.5 years ago by starting, you know, what's now We Heart Seattle, happens to be a 501c3 nonprofit, but we think of ourselves more as a movement for civic engagement. And our action strategy is these organized debris removals, primarily in active and abandoned encampments, where we intertwine naturally with people living rough and people who've also passed away. And we've found now over 12 passed away folks, our volunteers, in picking up the litter. And I always say the truth lies beneath the trash, because we show what's working and what's not working from a policy standpoint, which is what Tom is all about. And we have this like relationship, and I'm that grassroots, boots on the ground strategy, displaying, you know, what's working and what's not. You know, why have we picked up 1 million pounds of trash in our parks, shared spaces, green belts, and 35,000 used needles now, thousands of used fentanyl foil, the bodies, not just somebody that just passed away, but bodies that have been weeks unfound, years down to the skeleton in our green spaces in the city of Seattle. What's broken from a policy standpoint, and my means to the end, is to educate our voters and to increase voter turnout so we can turn the ship around and start saving lives, restoring public safety and tourism and the economy and all the things that go along with what's broke today.
Oh, that's perfect. I love that the truth lies beneath the trash. Tom, kick it over to you. Like, what is it about homelessness, addiction, and trash?
Well, you know, you have trash at your home. You take out the garbage every Tuesday night or every Wednesday night. I put out the trash, right? And it's always full. So imagine if you're living in a tent and you have nowhere to put out the trash to, right?
Yeah.
People still eat. They still have, you know, they drink water, they have water bottles. They still have to use the bathroom, all of those things. And none of those things are usually available to be in the way that it needs to be managed on the street. There's no infrastructure.
That's a good way to put it. To manage it.
Right. To manage it. So you end up with tons of trash piling up. You end up with feces on the street. You know, San Francisco has a huge problem with street poop.
Oh, yes.
It is what it is. And that's because they have only like 3 public bathrooms for a 48 block radius of where the majority of the homeless people in San Francisco congregate. And so there you have it. You have this huge problem with that. Ironically, in a city like San Francisco, we spend $275,000 a day cleaning our streets, like power washing the streets and picking up the garbage.
A little over a quarter million a day?
A day to clean our streets in the whole city of San Francisco. And, you know, if you go to the Tenderloin neighborhood and Market Street and south of Market neighborhoods and parts of the Mission District, they're filthy. It's just too much, because you've got these people that are living out there absent any infrastructure whatsoever. They're just living in a tent. So they throw their garbage where they can throw their garbage. They go to the bathroom where they can go to the bathroom. And that's contributing to what I call the destabilization of many of these West Coast cities.
It's precisely, and that lies in where your skill set came in. You recognize that there's a problem. And
well,
if we don't pick up the trash, we are a destabilized society, aren't we?
And the city of Seven Hills, Seattle is, the trash is on slopes in these beautiful green belts, the east, west Duwamish green belts, the Queen Anne McLean Trail, northwest, northeast Queen Anne, and our urban parks. And there's two policies in the city of Seattle, I'll repeat for those watched episode 1 and 2, that leave the trash right there. I get we take the trash out every week, but we're finding trash that's been there since the 80s. Our city has left the trash to be there.
Just covered in their foliage.
I mean, we're talking their archaeological digs where we're finding bubblegum wrappers and bottles from the 80s, 90s, 2000s, and forensically can see how old this camp is, you know, how long this skeleton has been here. And this is Dexter Avenue, steps from Queen Anne. Why aren't we picking up the trash at all?
Yeah.
At all. And then you add on illegal dumping and other people that are opportunistic illegal dumpers that then dump the trash onto the encampments. And then, of course, the other policy failure, it's an MDAR, multi-department rules that the city of Seattle agencies have to adopt. I don't know if police officers have to abide by this policy as well, but you're not allowed to go within 20 feet of a tent unless you're that very one specific human services department that may or may not be escorted with police anymore. Maybe the old navigation team was allowed to go within 20 feet of a tent, which is where we flag that there are people dying in RVs and vans right in front of us, right in our alley, right in those tents that we walk by as we're going to a baseball game, or in our greenbelt, in inhabitable trails, touted once our best urban hiking trails, where their bodies are laying and languishing and have been passed away for years unfound.
That's unbelievable. So it's almost like it's out of sight, out of mind. And so would that be an appropriate description of when you were in the depths of your addiction, you're on the street, but in essence, let's just say normal people like myself who are not addicted, that still go to home and whatever, have structure, you're out of sight, out of mind.
That's right. I'm out of sight. In fact, for many people, they fall off the grid. That's the term you use, right?
Yeah.
And we want to. When I became homeless, like I had that, that's when I gave up like any hope at all. Like I lost all hope. I wanted to disappear. I wanted to be off the grid. I didn't want anyone to bother me. I wanted to use my drugs alone. I didn't want the police to come. I didn't want outreach workers except for the ones handing out McChicken sandwiches. I wanted them. And then every Sunday morning, this Korean church would drive up with donuts and coffee and preach to us about how we're all heathens and give us donuts and coffee. I wanted those two because I got donuts and coffee and a McChicken sandwich.
Yeah, so you weren't necessarily forgotten about by other nonprofit groups that wanted to just try to build you up. But for the most part, day-to-day operations, you were out of sight, out of mind. Get out of my way.
I don't completely agree with that. The nonprofit groups, I don't think they were looking specifically to build me up. Oh. As much as they wanted to try to just address the situation and try to reduce the harm in the situation. It takes someone special to actually make those one-on-one connections with people. That's why I kind of gravitate towards Andrea, because she's special like that. Like she actually, like I was out with her today. We were at an encampment this morning talking to people, and within like 10 minutes, like we had brought water and juice and she made connections and she's talking to people about accessing detox and treatment. And they were actually like putting together a plan, right? That's the kind of outreach that needs to happen on the street in San Francisco. And ironically, you know, still to this day, the majority of the outreach that happens to the homeless in any major city in the United States is done by the police, period.
So let's unpack that then. So, you know, you and I briefly had a conversation before we started rolling here, and that we even mentioned in your opening description of who the hell you are. You talked about the police.
Yeah.
And can you describe, obviously I'm still a cop, but typically police officers, what we do is we go call the call, and we don't necessarily have the old school way of connecting with our beat, our sector, with individuals that we get to know, because we're consistently running call to call and we're understaffed. It's not an excuse, it's actual reality. But there was a copper in San Francisco PD that took a interest in you. Can you describe that encounter?
Yeah. So when I was put out of my home, and that was my own doing, I own that completely. You know, my wife was still deathly afraid and worried for what was going to happen to me. So she actually called SFPD and filed a missing persons report. And the cop that she talked to this day, still a friend of mine, his name is Rob Gilson, took her call, listened to her cry over the phone about how her husband was out on the street, addicted to drugs. And he kind of took a special interest in me. And, you know, it's funny, at the time, when you're out there on the street, you're like, why the hell are you bothering me? Leave me alone.
Sure.
Right. But in recovery, when you have a chance to reflect on your life, and you look at, and you look at your life through a lens of gratitude, which is one of the keys to your recovery as a human being, you understand that that cop actually took a special interest in my wife and myself, because he is the one that kept arresting me over and over out there on the street. And I thought he just had it out for me, but really what it was is my wife touched something in him, I think. And that, you know, and he would see me and he would tell me, dude, you're too old to be out here. And at the time I was 48. You're too old to be out here. You have a wife and kids at home. You need to go home and be with your family. And that was that same message that he would repeat over and over and over, until finally, you know, after my sixth arrest, you know, they just weren't going to let me out anymore. And I ended up going to jail for a few months and sobering up. But if it wasn't for that intervention, and that's the thing that I stress for people on the street, and it's maybe not fair to some people on the street, and I can understand where the harm reductionists come in and the defund the police people argue all this stuff about, oh, you shouldn't arrest people on the street. Well, you know what? There's a subset of people on the street that require intervention. I'm one of those people that required intervention. Had I not been intervened upon by the police, I would not be here today. Period. End of story.
That's pretty profound.
And that's just the bottom line. And anyone that wants to disagree with that, like, hey, you know, we can talk till you're blue in the face, but the bottom line is that I'm alive today in here because I was given an opportunity to find recovery, and that opportunity was given to me by the police. And that's something I'll always be grateful for. Period.
That's fantastic. Well, I think it shows you that the cops just were really, the majority of us just want to help people. That's why we gravitate to this job. It's public service.
Right.
But I would say that what, you know, Andrea is doing, We Heart Seattle, is public service on steroids as well, and it's action-based.
Well, it is. And look, you know, so look, everybody wants to find an alternative to policing in the criminal justice system for people experiencing homelessness. And there's two things I'd like to say about that.
Sure.
So number one, we all are afforded equal protection under the law in the United States. It's in our Constitution. So then why are we creating different standards of law for people experiencing homelessness on the street? I don't think that they should be subject to different standards of law than just you and me. If you go into a store and you steal and you get caught, you get held accountable. How come when someone who's struggling with fentanyl goes into a store and steals doesn't get held accountable? I'm just not, I don't understand the logic. I mean, I understand why they want to do that, but you want to make those changes and not provide any infrastructure to support those changes. All that's going to do is enable and embolden people to continue to do that over and over. And that's one of the big issues that we're facing.
Yeah, I think that's speaking truth right there. And I think what it, I think traditionally, Andrew, maybe you can correct me, but it's, I think perhaps Seattle's way of doing it, the activist cult class is what I call them. It's meeting people where they are. And then perhaps that's that criminal justice reform take of, we don't want to hold these people accountable because they're suffering from addiction. But I think what, Tom, you just described is, no, we need to not meet them where they are. We need to intervene. Is that what you're saying?
We need to meet them where they're at, but not leave them there.
Not leave them there.
That's the key.
That's the difference.
That's the difference. That's what Andrea, that's her philosophy. That's my philosophy. That's a lot of us, the Salvation Army's philosophy. We want to meet people where they're at and not leave them there. And again, if you don't want the criminal justice system to be involved, okay, then build the infrastructure to support our transition away from the criminal justice system. And we've had more than 10 years to do that in Washington, Oregon, and California, and we have failed to do that. And as a result, you have between those three states, almost 50% of the entire homeless population in the United States, period.
It's unbelievable.
It's really unreal.
What would your take on that be in terms of meeting people where they are?
Well, we're treating people like hospice patients right now until they eventually die. That's the current outreach model and approach is more sandwiches, more blankets, more tarps, more needles, more foil, more low barrier housing to where you eventually die. That's hospice. That's not intervention. That's not compassion. That's grim, cruel, and barbaric. And what I would like to see, and Tom touched on this morning when he came out with Tim and I, and saw multiple people pop out of their tent eager to talk about detox and recovery. Show me that path out. You know, here's a sandwich, here's some juice. We're not jerks. We have basic needs. People are hungry, they're thirsty. Pack tobacco, cigarettes are great street currency, and trust sticks. But we're talking to grandma, grandpa this morning. Within minutes, phone numbers, people were upright, and talking about what a path out looks like. In fact, Theo, who I met over a year ago, cried in my arms and said, I can't get arrested for my open warrants right now. And he wept because he felt remorseful for car prowling and porch pirating. And some men and women, of course, have to trade sex for 10 bucks to get through the next few hours to avoid withdrawal. And so just that whole ecosystem of predator and prey and the current outreach model of wait until people are ready, I don't believe is the right approach with fentanyl being the game changer. We need to be more assertive through motivational interviewing, through coaxing, which if you look up in the dictionary means gentle persuasion. And there's nothing wrong with tough love, love being the operative word.
So with that, we talked about trying to get intervention, correct? Here's London Breed, San Francisco's mayor, brief 30 seconds of her saying, harm reduction, from my perspective, is not reducing the harm.
And I am unapologetic in my investments in making sure that we have outpatient support, making sure that we have on-demand resources for those who are asking for treatment, that we are making it easier to help people than to harm people. Because you know what? Harm reduction, from my perspective, is not reducing the harm.
This is San Francisco, believe it or not.
But Tom, what is she talking about?
Well, I was standing about 10 feet away from her when she said that.
Yeah.
And that was after we did a march against fentanyl in San Francisco. Like, the recovery community in San Francisco decided to come together, and there was about 200 of us, and we decided to march through the Tenderloin over to City Hall and demand that San Francisco shut down its open-air drug markets and demand that they bring recovery to the people.
And this is the march you're referring to.
That's correct. And I was right in the middle of it.
And I'll let this play out in just a minute because it's been a minute long.
Yep.
And I'm just ripping this right from your Axe feed.
Yep.
Fentanyl kills, folks. Fentanyl That's why we're kills. Here. Fentanyl kills.
Fentanyl kills.
And recovery works. That's why we're marching. We're marching today for recovery and to stop the open-air drug markets and to stop fentanyl in San Francisco. 800 people have died in the last year in San Francisco to drug overdose, and we have no response to it. So we're taking to the streets to put pressure on our elected leaders to make them change and focus on recovery as a solution to this. No more fentanyl. Close down the open arm air drug markets. Hold drug dealers accountable. We've had enough.
So then, great march, by the way.
Yeah.
Excellent message.
Yeah.
But then her brief press conference is in response to this. Would you elaborate on that?
So two things. One, you know, the city has responded. They just haven't responded well. And they've spent hundreds of millions. I mean, actually, if you look at it, over the last 4 years, San Francisco spent just on behavioral health about $2.4 billion.
That is not a small amount of money.
Not a small amount of money. And we actually had a 25% increase in drug overdose on the street. Last year, SFPD arrested 930 drug dealers on the street in San Francisco. We estimate we have about 1,000. So they basically arrested all the drug dealers in San Francisco. You'd be like, yeah, problem's over. Nope. The courts released like 880 of them back to the street.
And they're not charging them, or we don't know.
The charges are ongoing and pending, right? I mean, they just extradited three fugitive drug dealers from Honduras back to San Francisco to face charges for them skipping out on their bail when they got bailed out last time a couple of years ago. I mean, this is how bad it is, right?
So on the back end, the criminal justice aspect of these dealers, we're not taking that serious enough.
No. I mean, look, there's the war on drugs failed. You hear that narrative all the time, right? Well, just basic accountability isn't the war on drugs. And Look, yeah, in the 90s, we were probably too draconian and just took a law enforcement only approach to drug possession and drug dealing. But you know, it's 2024. We already know that we can't do that again. What it's going to take is it's going to take a partnership between law enforcement and the criminal justice system and public health, working hand in hand to actually make an impact on the drug crisis that we see in every major city. And right now, in the United States, those two agencies couldn't be further apart. And it's really tragic. If you look at what they do in Europe, as an example, I'll just say Amsterdam. When they go and do outreach on the street like Andrea does, it would be Andrea and her group and a cop together.
Working to hand in hand.
Working and someone from the public health department, all together as buddies, all hanging out, breaking up these open drug scenes, getting people to shelter, getting people into recovery, and holding people accountable. But here, we don't want that. And so you see...
Why do you think we don't want that? Like, why is that such an adversarial position?
Okay, so I'm just going to be brutally honest, and it's going to be
what this is all about.
A little controversial. But look, you know, harm reduction is part of the social justice movement. It is. It's a social justice issue.
Ideology, then.
Yeah, of course. So it's like, you know, the cops are bad. ACAB, mm-hmm. right? Defund the police. That's all a social justice issue. Harm reduction is under that same umbrella. Okay. So if all cops are bad and you want to defund the police and it's harm reduction, that means under no circumstances can harm reduction work with law enforcement in any way whatsoever, even though that's complete bullshit. Of course it can.
Right.
If it wasn't working, then how did I get Suboxone when I was in county jail to help me wean off of the fentanyl I was addicted to?
Or how did you have a cop reach in and try to and save you, basically?
That's right. How? He was reducing harm.
So I think what you're describing, I'm putting words in your mouth, if I am, light me up. But I think what you're describing is there's an activist class that pushes this harm reduction model. And it's the three pillars I think you just described. And it's all based in defund the police movement, criminal justice reform.
Yeah, criminal justice reform. So first of all, the way criminal justice reform has been interpreted has failed.
I would agree 100%.
Okay, so criminal justice reform as an idea has merit and could work if implemented correctly, i.e. reducing the prison population for low-level offenders. Cool, man. If you went to prison because you were selling 50 pounds of marijuana out of the back of your car in the 1980s, yeah, you should probably be let out of prison. But to what? Let out to what?
Yeah, back to the streets.
You just spent 25 years in the hole and you get left and you get let out to nothing. Your family's gone. Your community doesn't want you. You can't get a job because you're a convicted felon and they put you in a halfway house for 90 days or 6 months to get your shit together. And you're actually, the halfway house happens to be in the Tenderloin where all the drugs are. And you tell me that interpretation of criminal justice reform is working. Of course it's not. If you want to do that kind of reform, cool. Build the infrastructure to support it. And if you do that, then maybe you have a chance to actually make a difference.
And does the infrastructure obviously have the note of recovery, programs, counseling?
Absolutely. It's part of a full continuum of care.
Okay, so we have a program here in Seattle. It's been going on for a number of years called LEAD. Law Enforcement Assisted Drug Diversion,
yeah,
which I think has been an abysmal failure.
Yeah, don't get me started on LEAD, man.
No, that's why I bring it up, because I think what it just really embodies is the fact that...
I'm going to be kinder than that and say it's well-intentioned with terrible implementation and even worse outcomes.
So then how do we change it?
Well, you just have to maybe scrap it and take a step back and look at like... You know who does good work is like the reentry divisions in some counties actually do good work. People that are exiting the criminal justice system that end up on probation. Mm. Most larger probation departments like San Francisco Adult Probation actually has a really good reentry program because the guy that built it was in prison at one point in his life and turned his life around and got a master's degree and was running the program and designed like 45 different programs for people exiting the criminal justice system, for justice-involved adults, right, to access services and housing and treatment. And that actually had some success. So there are models out there that work.
Pioneer Human Services is our reentry program here in Seattle. WeldWorks, Oxford Housing, family-oriented programs like Battlefield Addiction, Remnant Army. Nobody hears about these programs, though, or the Salvation Army as being reentry programs when people do get discharged from jail. My favorite one in Portland, Oregon is Bybee Lakes Hope Center, who begs for crumb funding from Multnomah County and yet run one of the most successful housing projects in Multnomah County.
But here we are talking about San Francisco spending over $250,000 a day in cleaning, which is obviously needs to get done.
Yep.
But then we've thrown so much money at something that seems to be just wasted.
Yeah. I mean, it's an ideological issue. it's a policy issue. It's the way that the two words evidence-based have been defined in policy around housing and around drugs. Put all of those things together, and then you have this overarching kind of guilt. That book, White Fragility, that came out a few years back?
Of course, yeah.
That overarching kind of progressive white guilt of well-to-do folks that live in the burbs that vote for these things?
Well, that's why I say it goes back to out of sight, out of mind. Unless it impacts their doorstep, they're not going to get involved. Or if they feel like they drive by, they feel bad, they'll cut a quick check and feel good about themselves.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it doesn't really get done.
Well, what is the term that they use? Luxury beliefs, right? Mm. So when you're well off living in a suburb and you have a good amount of money and you have a BMW, you can afford to have luxury beliefs because that problem is not on your doorstep. But for people like Andrea and myself to spend a lot of time in communities of color that are marginalized communities,
sure,
that is where we absolutely see the most suffering. That is occurring, not just the most crime and violence, but the most suffering, the most drug addiction, the most amount of preying and exploitation amongst this marginalized
victims.
Group. Right. And I'm just like, you hear all these people throw around the word equity like a football, but you go to Skid Row in LA, you go to the Tenderloin in San Francisco, you go to the Blade in Seattle. It's the most inequitable thing you will ever see. So you can't sit there and tell me that the policies that we've implemented over the last decade or so up and down the West Coast are working, because they clearly are not working, because we are failing, again, despite all the billions of dollars, to build an adequate infrastructure to support those changes.
That's tragic. And I think what it does is shows you from our side of the house in terms of police public safety is cops just want to do their job, but we're also handcuffed. So if we do say, for instance, I'm the officer that rescued you, a better way of saying it. Right now in Seattle, if I were to try to do that, I wouldn't be able to book you into jail.
Right.
You'd be able to get out really fast.
If I was on the street today in San Francisco, I'd already be dead. I'm completely convinced that I would already be dead. Because instead of getting arrested for violating the stay away order that I had, I would have gotten a ticket. And three of the six times I got arrested, it was for violating my stay away order. The other three times I was holding drugs for the dealers. It's true, I was a mule for them. That's how a lot of homeless people are exploited on the street in San Francisco. You hold the dope for the dealers and then they pay you with fentanyl. That's their payment.
I'm sure that's how it's done here in Seattle as well.
I'm sure. And then if you get busted, guess what? You take the fall, not them.
So it was the carrot and the stick meaning the officers had the ability to remove your civil liberties from you. Right?
Well, I broke the law.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even removing the civil liberty. I violated civil liberties.
The problem is people are breaking the law today, and then there's no recourse.
Well, there's not enough. There's not enough recourse. You know, I mean, I guess you could still arrest someone, and you hear all the criminal justice reform advocates argue, these misdemeanors for shoplifting are still punishable up to 6 months in jail. And I tell them very, very calmly, the police do not get to make the decision of how much time that individual goes to jail. That happens 13 months later in a court system as part of a plea bargain.
You absolutely nailed it.
Okay. So all the cop can do is go and do the arrest or not based on the level of the charge that is before them. And if it's because the guy stole 50 toothbrushes, well, that's under $950 in California, which is a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
And so the police have a decision to make. Do I arrest him, fill out 4 hours of paperwork to have him be released in 8 hours or even be a let go? arrest him, take him down to count to the sheriff, and then the sheriff turns around and releases him the same day with a pending court date that he may or may not show up to. And now that cop is off the street for the next 4 hours filling out all this paperwork on that report.
And I think that's a deliberate tactic to try to hinder our ability to be that stick that actually holds people accountable. I think it's all intentional.
It's not a think, it's actual fact.
Yeah, I would completely agree.
Tons of paperwork was added to police reports across America since 2020. And there's a ballot initiative on the ballot on March 5th in San Francisco that would actually help reduce some of that paperwork and increase surveillance options for police to try to help the police do their job a little bit better. And that's just kind of showing some of the adjustments that are being made as of this, you know, to try to bring the pendulum back towards the middle from where it has been around policing the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. That's a based perspective for you to have. Do you see that is happening here as well, Andrew?
I do, but I mean, what I'm concerned about, and I know the answer is obvious, you know, is the collateral damage and the four people a day dying in King County, half being indoors, Oregon reporting, what, like a 90% increase in overdose deaths, the backlash of legalizing these drugs, and that the unwillingness to change position, mind, ideology in the name of saving lives. The blood is on the watch of these policymakers, these activists that have pushed this very far left progressive policy into our communities, into our cities, and poor lazy journalism isn't bifurcating the difference between the need for low-income affordable housing for moms, single moms, veterans, senior citizens, and what we need to do for the folks dying at, what, 72% increase, overdose rate increase year over year. Two separate issues, two separate populations. That's my concern, is that, you know, we're talking a lot about all these poor policies, and ultimately the end result is an increase in death toll. And who's responsible for that? You know, there's Dr. Raul Garcia, who's been out litter picking, is running for U.S. Senate, and he plans to launch a Americans Against Fentanyl Act and have a federal mandate that states can adopt to arrest and penalize dealers for manslaughter. And I think when you start talking that type of accountability and penalty for dealers, mules that are aiding and abetting the number one cause of death for our, age 35 to...
Age 18 to 45.
18 to 45, the number one cause of death, isn't that dealing somebody their death sentence?
Yeah, you're right. It's tricky, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I agree with you to an extent. So look, there's a couple of realities we have to face. By this time next year, drug overdose will be the leading cause of death for everyone under the age of 60 in the United States. It's going to pass heart disease and cancer by this time
number
next year.
Number one.
So we really have to decide like how we're going to abate that. Okay. Are we going to just sit around and wait for it to plateau when all the people that are already deep in late stage addiction just die off? Or are we going to take some action on both sides of this?
All right, so does the action start, let's get real down to the brass tacks here. Yep. Does the action start at the border? Does this start with China? Can you try to connect with us? How is the fentanyl so prevalent in the West Coast cities?
Okay, I'm just going to say it like what I think. So I think the problem lies with the cartels. I know that they get the chemicals from China, but those chemicals can be gotten in other countries too. It's just really easy to get from China, but that doesn't mean you can't get them. You can get heroin really easy in Afghanistan, but you can also get heroin from Turkey. So, you know, what, are we going to just go nuke Afghanistan? That's not going to end the heroin problem. Okay. It's the people that are facilitating the manufacturing and distribution of the drugs that we need to consider, which are the Sinaloa cartel and the cartel Nueva Generacion, and the 70 other cartels in Mexico, okay? The problem is that that's a different country. And so while I don't know about y'all, what everybody, you know, this is the dichotomy that I think the conservatives have to reconcile, I'll be frank. Okay, I agree with the conservatives about the border. We need to secure the border. But I also agree with conservatives that we are a sovereign nation with borders that need to be respected. If we're going to demand and command that respect, then we need to give that respect to other countries too, i.e. Mexico. So we can't just go in and go Sicario and start bombing the cartels in Mexico without Mexico's blessing. So we need to find a way to entice Mexico's government, whether it be by carrot or stick, to get on board with trying to dismantle the cartel. They, however, are afraid to do so because of all the previous drug wars that were happening in northern Mexico down to Acapulco in the past that completely destabilized the entire country of Mexico.
100%.
And they have made a deal with the cartels, and a lot of that bloodshed has stopped, and now Mexico's having a renaissance of sorts. If you go to Mexico City right now, it's pristine. It's beautiful. Okay? So we really have our work cut out for us as to how we're going to incentivize the government of Mexico to help us abate the actual supply that's coming in. And at the same time, we need to get really serious about ramping up our public health approaches because they're deficient, right? That's one thing maybe the harm reduction people are right about. There's not enough services out there. But Andrea and I say the same thing, and we're not pro-harm reduction. We know there's not enough treatment out there. That's one of the keystones of my advocacy, is that we have treatment on demand and that we start thinking not just in the hundreds of treatment beds, but in the thousands.
Treatment on demand.
Treatment on demand.
That's actually a really cool concept.
Yeah.
Make it.
So like today, for instance, you did the outreach.
Yep.
You had the ability to do treatment on demand today.
We can, you know, there are hundreds of beds available across the state of Washington. You know, people need to be stabilized for 3 to 5 days and then discharged to longer term inpatient 6 month program minimum to get through to a point of self-sufficiency on their own. But one person at a time can be done. You know, we're not trying to overnight take 5, 6, 7, 8,000 people and put them into treatment all on the same day. But if we take the approach of at the outreach step to at least have the conversation, we're one step ahead of where we are yesterday, which is you're not allowed to bring up drug and alcohol treatment at all. It's considered to be stigmatizing the addict. And if you bring up treatment when they come in for their pipe or their sandwich or their food stamp card, then they may not come in at all. And so then therefore there's no chance of building trust, which I just think is a really backwards approach. Always bring up, is today a good day to pick up the phone and call grandma and grandpa to see that you can go home after detox. So that I think we should change the model and the approach at the outreach. And any outreach organizations that's not willing to do that, I think should be defunded.
How do we do that? All politics is local.
Well, for starters, you can fund private entities that may be adopting the very working policy that Tom's talking about, and that's We Heart Seattle. On a very micro level, we are adopting and applying and housing people using that model of compassionate intervention. Detox, go home to mom. Detox, go home to wife. Detox, maybe go serve your warrants and not run from them. I have 2-3 men that call me from prison weekly and say they are being rehabilitated. They're sleeping. They're not running from the law. And outreach needs to encourage, coax, persuade folks running from their warrants to take care of them. Maybe it's through the lead program or serving time or negotiating some other drug court out, but holding people accountable is evolving them to self-sufficiency. And that's where we need the outreach to do. And if you're not doing that, you should be defunded. That's how you get to that point, is either adopt a new approach or you're done.
Can I just add to that?
Absolutely.
So, no, I really believe that accountability is a cornerstone of recovery. I've said that to you before. But I also believe that harm reduction can play a role in all of this. So there's a guy that I met out on the street today that is addicted to opioids because he was cut off from his oxycodone supply that he was getting from his doctor because he's in constant pain because he's had 7 surgeries on his arm, right? That guy needs an alternative from just getting clean, because otherwise he's going to be in pain all the time. and he's going to be clean, and he's not going to stay clean because he's in pain all the time. This is where harm reduction can step in and help that individual, right? But there are other individuals that we met today that just are addicted to drugs and are homeless because they committed crimes and they're absconding from the law. And they need to go handle their accountability portion of it and at the same time get rehabilitated and then go back home. So there's no one size fits all, but we've chosen to treat what's happening on the street as a one size fits all.
Yeah, but, it's forced. There's, you know,
individualized outreach, case by case, with strong, assertive case managers and case navigators that, you know, we need to diversify the type of people we hire into the space as well. Lived experience, sure. Business managers, people with finance degrees to maybe run the books would have helped this last $11 million debacle that was we are in, now we are out, that King County Regional Housing Authority was able to do a public-private collaboration last year and the year before. All went to salaries. All those people are gone. So bring people in with a diverse set of skill sets, not just social workers.
Right. There's 1,000 different causes of homelessness, man. Just hundreds and hundreds of different ways that you can become homeless.
Well, it could be any one of us. I mean, I've had surgery before.
Yeah, it could right? be. It could be addiction. It could be early childhood trauma. It could be domestic violence. It could be abuse. It could be loss of job.
One paycheck away.
One paycheck. All these different reasons. So then why, if homelessness in and of itself is not monolithic, why are we treating it as a monolithic problem and that everybody just needs housing and then we'll fix everything after? That's basically the solution.
Yeah, well, it seems more of a political solution based upon ideology.
But it's gone beyond that because now we're talking about billions and billions of dollars.
Big money.
That could be allocated differently. Not away from, but just differently. I always use the term enlarge the solution space. Let's open up the solution space and allow for sober housing and recovery-based housing and more integrated outreach and more integrated treatment services and treatment on demand, all to be part of this is like a flower.
Is treatment, correct me if I'm wrong, but could one make the jump that treatment on demand is forced treatment?
No, no. Treatment on demand means exactly that. You're ready to go to treatment, I can have you in a detox bed.
Well, how do we know if somebody's ready or not?
Because they'll tell you they're ready. And if they're not ready, this is where the intervention comes in. If they're breaking the law to support their addiction, okay? I want to make it clear. It's not against the law to be homeless, at least not in San Francisco.
It's not in Seattle either.
And it's not against the law to be addicted to drugs, at least not in San Francisco. But it is against the law to go into Walgreens and Boost.
Correct.
Okay? And so people that are exhibiting those behaviors as a result of their addiction, it's okay to hold them accountable and refer them to drug court so that they can get mandated into treatment.
That's where LEAD could come in and actually have some bite.
Perhaps.
What about public intoxication of fentanyl? Is that not an arrestable crime now? I thought we passed our ordinance here that the cops do have that tool to arrest for open air use of narcotics, but they're typically picking people up on open warrants.
Well, we do have that tool for sure, but I was just kind of lamenting with Tom here. It's like we take people to jail, but then the jail just kicks them loose.
So that, I mean, there's a lot, everybody has to get on the same page, right?
Yeah.
Not everybody's on the same page.
Yeah.
I mean, our sheriff and our police aren't necessarily on the
same page. So when do you think we will be on the same page? I mean, I see the work you're doing in San Francisco, which is outstanding. I see the work that Andrew is doing with We Heart Seattle. I mean, it's compelling leadership with action. But I guess the big question is how many more people need to die before out of sight, out of mind stops?
I think we're getting closer.
Okay, so there's hope.
Yeah, I don't think we're there yet. I think it's going to be a few more years. There's too much money wrapped up in it. I was explaining to Andrea that it's a marathon for us to try to unravel some of the policies that are in place.
Sure.
And it's going to take time. And unfortunately, people are dying along the way, and that's tragic. But it should be a rallying cry every time someone dies of a drug overdose on the street under the current drug policies and homeless policies that we have. It should be a rallying cry for everyone out there that votes, to really think and vote accordingly.
That's a fantastic message. Yeah. It really is nice.
Thank you.
Vote.
That's your action plan.
Yeah. Vote. Use our direct action strategies to educate voters, educate our friends that are in the suburbs that aren't coming to the city. Let them know what's going on and how to separate, fulfilling their guilt of voting for everything around housing levies and more affordable housing. Of course, more affordable housing always, but that's not what's going on with this death toll and the fentanyl state of emergency, which Governor Inslee should proclaim. Don't you think we should be in a state of emergency? Do you think Oregon's on track for that this hot mess bed that they made that they should be laying in?
So San Francisco is a little gun shy about state of emergencies, but yes, we should be in a state of emergency. I only say that because we declared a state of emergency a couple of years ago in the Tenderloin, and $22 million later, we had this safe injection site open and nobody got clean, and it was a big disaster. So again, we can declare the state of emergency to unlock funds, but this is where policy really matters. Because now, who's in charge of deciding how those funds get spent?
How much of that is connected to Sacramento?
A ton. A ton of it
is the same thing here in Olympia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. State law makes a difference. State policy is huge.
Yeah, 100%. Tom, where can people find you?
I live on X, Twitter. My handle is TWolfRecovery. If you want to find out more about me or contact me, you can go to my website. It's www.gooddrugpolicy.org/PAPR. That's my bio's in there, my contact information. I have my own nonprofit, and I'm part of a larger foundation called the Foundation for Drug Policy Solutions. And you can also find me doing some work for the Salvation Army in San Francisco, trying to bring a recovery system of care to the city.
Perfect. Andrea, where can people find you?
WeHeartSeattle.org. I'm also on X, WeHeartSeattle, and at WeHeartFounder. We have weekly organized litter picks. We're at, I think, over 350 organized litter picks thus far every weekend. Corporate serve days, bring your soccer club out, your book club. It's a great way to meet the community, and civic engagement will fill those gaps to support the government where they could use some help. So vote for the backyard that you want to live every day by volunteering. That's our mantra, is that volunteerism is and community response is a great way to help out our cops. And our social workers and other charitable organizations that are doing their part to come out, vote with your boots, and come educate yourself so you're educated when you hit the ballot box this fall.
Two great messages. I want to thank both of you for being here. It takes leadership and courage, and very humbled. As a public servant, I'm just clocking in and out. And there was a time when I was in patrol and I would try to touch base with the people that I served. But what you guys are doing and your lived experience, and your lived experience too, Andrea, for sure, in terms of the, I would call you a first responder almost. It's quite humbling to see two people that actually give a shit.
We do.
And you have solutions, and your action plans suggest that those solutions are actionable and have no doubt. In my mind, move the needle in trying to solve this, or at least significantly reduce the craziness that's impacting the West Coast.
Thank you, Mike. And your Hold the Line platform here is your action. So thank you for helping raise, our voices and everyone that's been on the show. It really is reaching a large audience. I have people coming up all the time talking about our prior recordings. I know we're trying to wrap up, but Chelan County has invited me out to talk with Wenatchee, that whole or the Chelan County area leaders, mayors, chief of police, to talk about our working model, even though it's a small scale, but it is adopting kind of the policy direction that we're talking about today. So it's through this podcast that we're getting the word out. So thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. You mentioned a number of issues, the things that have impacted you to help you get to recovery. One thing I wanted to ask you is faith. Did faith have, and whatever higher power that you use for faith or that you consume for to really scratch that itch for you, what is that? How much did it help you? And do you feel, more broadly speaking, that one of the reasons why we're in the predicament we are in today with this fentanyl crisis, this homeless crisis, is because of lack of faith?
I think, well, first of all, faith played a huge part in my recovery. I know for some people it didn't, but I do know that people that I talk to in the recovery community, and I include myself, that when you fall into addiction, part of being sick with addiction is that you are spiritually sick as well. You lose faith. You lose hope. You don't think that anyone's looking out for you anymore. And usually what gets you into trouble is that you think you've got everything under control, and you really don't. And what's great about having faith is that you learn to kind of let go of a lot of the things that you think you're supposed to be able to control, and you kind of give it over to a higher power, where you realize that, you know what, you really don't control shit. Your higher power does, and he or they lay out a path for you, and you have free will and whether or not you choose to follow it. I made a conscious decision when I gave recovery an honest try that I was going to try to walk the path that God laid out before me and trust that whatever path he laid out before me was good, and he was right. And my life has been changed ever since. And having faith, letting faith into my heart and letting it into my family has helped transform me and my family into better people. And that we're full of hope. We're full of love. We're honest with each other. It's easier for us to work through our problems together. We have more communication together as a result of it. Do I go to church every Sunday? No, I don't. But I have a tremendous amount of faith in a higher power. And I choose to call that higher power Jesus. That's me. But if it's Buddha for you, it's all good. As long as you believe in a power greater than yourself, I think that takes a lot of the pressure off of an individual, especially someone that's maybe a dad or a mom that has responsibilities like kids. Whether you're in addiction or not, it just takes some of that pressure off, knowing that you're absolutely not alone.
That's a fantastic message. And I found myself getting a bit emotional just listening to you, because I think I could feel the emotion coming from you when you were talking about that. That's absolutely real.
Can I say one more thing?
Of course.
So look, when I went into rehab, I was in a 30-day blackout. I couldn't call my mom or my dad, or, you know, I needed money, you know, to buy cigarettes, honestly, to buy cigarettes because I smoked. And so I wrote my mom a letter saying, "Hey, Mom, I just want to let you know I'm out of jail and I'm now in rehab. And if there's any way you could send me like $60 so I could buy some cigarettes, I'd be really grateful. If not, it's cool. I understand." And about 10 days later, I get a letter from my mom with $60 in it, with a postcard that said, "Whenever you turn your back on God, God still has your back." And then on the other side of that, she says, "I want you to read the book of Luke in the Bible." And there's a passage in there that talks about the prodigal son. And there's another passage in there that talks about the lost sheep, about leaving the 99 to go find the one lost sheep and bring it back. And that's what God does for you. And as a 48-year-old man, I sat there in rehab and I cried. I cried because for the first time in my life, I really felt like there was someone else beyond us that was looking out for me. And that came from my mom, and I'll always be grateful to her for that, because that opened the door for me to start thinking, wow, maybe there's hope. Maybe I'm not alone. And I still had a long way to go. I had to go through all of drug rehab, but at one point during that rehab, I finally started to see a little glimmer of light, a little glimmer of hope that I could get my family back, and that I could maybe have some kind of life that wasn't relegated to the street or jail or drugs. And it was through that faith that helped inspire my recovery and bring me to where I am today.
Thank you for sharing that, man. That's that moves the needle for me, for sure. Andrea.
Thank you for sharing that, Tom. At We Heart, you know, we use the term magic a lot, and just fate and running into the right person at the right time. And it is service above self. You know, it's a higher service is my higher power. So it keeps me going every day. It fills my spiritual void. And Rotarians, got to give a shout out. You know, they are salt of the earth folks that have adopted WeHeart and myself, them. And, you know, they're out there every day volunteering and putting themselves, again, service above self, and honoring their four pillars of service. And one being, is it the truth? And, you know, you mentioned at lunch, you know, just faith, having, you know, realizing you can't have to trust what you can't control, but together and through community and fellowship and that energy of like-mindedness pulling together in critical mass is about as religious as I can get and feel. It's very fulfilling when you have community working together, lock and step, to serve and to, in this case, really try to save lives. So that's kind of my position. I don't have Jesus, but there's something there pulling me in this direction hard. And I think about it every single day. And I'm grateful for that feeling.
Wow. Well, two great people I've had the honor to be amongst. I want to thank you both for taking the time to be on this podcast and for your action and for your lived experiences. And I think your dedication to just humanity, trying to solve some problems.
Well, thank you, man.
Thank you very much.
It's great to be
here. Very, very compelling. Thank you so much. Hey, thanks for holding the line with Mike Solon. I think if we embody these two great people that have taken the time out of their busy schedules and we listen to them, and perhaps then we can emulate what they're clearly doing in terms of action, getting results. And perhaps we all can continue to hold the line. Thanks again.